free my mind, open my heart with the whispers of truth, to live a conscious life, to live a conscious life on the growing edge.
And now, here's Ali.
Hello and good morning and welcome to Growing Edge Live. I'm Dr. Ali Benjamin, and every week we join together here on New Thought Media Network to have a conversation with a soul-centered individual that is channeling their time, their energy, their creativity, their passions into doing good work in the world, into helping others and shining their light. And today I'm very excited because I'm going to be sharing a friend of mine, Dr. Michelle Medrano, with you. And it's bound to be a really lively conversation. And I'm really, really glad that she's the guest today and that you're here and you're going to meet her and get to know her a little bit better as well. And so I'm starting our show today, like I always do, with the Ask Ali segment. So here we go. I have a question from Greg. And Greg says, "Hi, Ali. I grew up in a very religious Christian family. In my teens, I decided not to attend church with my family. And after many years of not having much of an interest in spirituality, I have recently felt an urge to do a little bit more exploration. I've been reading and following several people in this human potential and self-help genres. I have also been doing yoga and meditating. Now I want to include prayer. When I do a prayer, I seem to fall back into the prayers of my childhood, and this doesn't feel right. I've heard your prayers, and they sound and feel very different, and I like it. Can you share some thoughts on prayer? Thank you." Well, thank you, Greg. This is a great question. Prayer is very different for me as I have been introduced to New Thought, even though it was 30-something years ago. The prayers of my childhood sounded really different than the prayers I'm accustomed to practicing, speaking these days. So the old style prayers of my childhood, and it sounds like yours too, were more of a begging and beseeching a deity outside of myself, some guy in the sky that was going to hear my prayers. And they were usually when I was younger for something I wanted. And if I was good, I knew that I would receive that prayer or that blessing or that answer. And if I wasn't, I wouldn't. And that's how it seemed to roll. And so that was then, but now, and you said you've heard a couple of the prayers that I've shared. Now it's a very different experience. I love to do prayers every day. Following my meditation, I usually slide into a prayer. And it's more of a meditative going inside process. And I actually use 5 steps that I learned when I was becoming a practitioner of New Thought, of Science of Mind. And so it's a deep centering and preparing myself to be really present in the now moment. And I usually do it after lighting a candle or like I said, a short meditation. And then I go into this place of deeply turning inwards and connecting with that place where I feel the spirit or God or the divine. And that's right here in my heart center. Some, if you're doing yoga, like you said, that's the heart chakra. And so I sort of drop down. I take that 18-inch journey from the head, the brain, into the heart. And it's in this place that I create an atmosphere for myself to have a very deep personal conversation, not with something outside of me, but the indwelling God, the spirit within me. Because in my awareness, what I believe is that we're all connected, that there's not a spot that God is not. And when I can become very still inside my heart and feel that warmth and the appreciation for being alive, I connect with that, what I'm calling God. You may have another name for it, but that's where we feel it, right inside ourselves. And so in that space, once I'm centered and still, done my meditation, and I go within, and I connect with that feeling of love, I recognize, it's like I remember, I tell myself a series of things that help me remember what's really going on here, that there's only one life. This life is God's life. This life is perfect. This life is my life now. And I start to really feel that there's something amazing happening. It's this grand, great, creative life that we're all living and experiencing. So I recognize that, and I say some things to myself in the quiet of my own heart that remind me of oneness, of how we're all connected, interdependent, interrelated, that what goes on right here, this feeling of connection, somehow moves out energetically, vibrationally out into the universe. So everything is affected by what's going on in my heart, my prayer. And that recognition, that affirmation that we're all one, we're all connected, that this life is magnificent and perfect just as it is, even though things on the outside may not be going exactly how we want them, there's something within us that knows that everything is unfolding perfectly. So I remember that. I recognize that truth. And I unify. That's the second step. I feel creative myself, just as I know that God is creative, that there's an evolution going on in the outer world, in the cosmos. There's also me inside. I'm creative. There's an evolution going on inside me. So I start to stir up these feelings of possibilities and potentialities that have to do with me being creative and speaking my word or silently sharing my thoughts inside of my heart. And then I move into the third phase, which is realization. And in this phase, in this step, I start to declare what it is that I know about myself and what I want to experience as myself, joy and peace and serenity and calm and creativity and knowledge and knowing and understanding. And I start to say sentences. I declare things that are true for me, or maybe another way of thinking of it, things that I'm coming into alignment with, maybe more abundance or healthier relationships or more meaningful spiritual practice or more vibrancy with my relationship. Or maybe it's work. Maybe I want to breathe some fresh air into my work life. So I make some declarative, affirmative statements in this realization phase. And as I start to say them, something magical happens. I start to feel it, like it's actually happening now. And that's the whole point of this kind of prayer, is to generate and cultivate the feeling nature of what it is we're coming into alignment with. I'm willing to express myself more authentically. I'm now willing to share my love with my coworkers. I'm willing to take a walk every day because I love feeling healthy and fit. Whatever it is, make those statements. Start to feel like that man, that woman, that individual that's actually feeling that. Why do we do this? Because this is the language that the universe responds to. God responds to. The vibration, the feeling tone, the emotions, the energy, the love, the appreciation. This is what sets the law into motion. And that's what we're doing with these thoughts, these words, these declarations. And then I move into the fourth stage, which is thanksgiving. I give a lot of praise and appreciation for the prayer. It's already done. It's already happening. And then I release it. I turn it over into the hands that know the how, God. And I just leave the how and the when up to divine right timing, divine right order, because that's what I believe. It doesn't always have to happen on my timeline with my agenda, but the best and highest good for all. So Greg, I hope this has helped. I hope this five-step affirmative prayer treatment process will help you as you grow and you start to become a conscious co-creator in your life. And many blessings to you. And thanks for this question. And if you have a question you'd like me to dive into, please send it there to growingedgelive@gmail.com. And we will add you to the Ask Allie segment. So thanks, Greg. All right. So now we're going to meet my amazing friend, Reverend Dr. Michelle Medrano. And Michelle is a New Thought leader, motivational speaker. She's an author. Michelle lives with her husband in Denver. She is a mother and a spiritual seeker of knowledge. And she has been her whole life. We'll get to hear about that. And she's been very curious about how humans work and how one finds fulfillment and satisfaction. She is also a career minister in the New Thought movement. She received her ministerial degree at the School of Ministry at Mile High Church in 1991. Wow, that was a while ago. The Huntington Beach Church of Religious Science hired her as an assistant minister, and she served in that capacity for 4 years. Then she was blessed to serve as senior minister of New Vision Center for 17 years. And then in 2013, she was invited back to Mile High to serve as an associate minister. And then in the spring of 2019, she joined Rev Joshua Reeves as the co-lead minister of Mile High Church. Michelle Medrano, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here today.
Thanks, Allie. Wonderful to be here. And I really enjoyed those 10 minutes of you answering Greg's question. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Yeah, I love talking about prayer.
Me too.
And it's not just something, I know you probably feel this way too, having been a minister most of your life, more than half of your life. Yeah, a lot more. Prayer is actually the way we move and be in the world. Once we've sort of had this waking up to the fact that we're creative beings, that our thoughts and our words, you know, create our reality, we're very mindful of, you know, how we roll, and staying in this heart-centered place of speaking truth, knowing that those words that we speak somehow materialize or become our experience. It's not just a practice we do in the morning. It's something that we do as we move through the day. True?
Well, I agree with you. And I think if you think of it the way you're talking about, which I totally agree with, the reality is we are constantly in a state of prayer. It just becomes, are we in a formal state of prayer where we're doing what you're talking about, which we're consciously allowing that energy, that divine creative energy that is always flowing through us, to do so more mindfully with an awareness such as an affirmation or an intentionality or a spiritual mind treatment, as you've just outlined? Or is it just happening willy-nilly? I have this little magnet that says, if you think willy-nilly thoughts, you get a willy-nilly life. Because what most people are doing is they're just kind of constantly thinking about this and thinking about that. And then they have some great idea, and then they're nullifying it, and they're avoiding it, and they're neutralizing it, and they can't keep track of it. But what you just described, prayerful consciousness, is a way to really get into an alignment with intentionality and use that co-creative energy. That's just, it's already happening. It's like electricity. Electricity is flowing through this universe. It's everywhere on this planet. But when you take the instruments and put it together right, you channel it intentionally, and it can do great things. And I think that's how I see spirit and how I see prayer, that we're always in prayer. And when we stop to consciously pray anytime throughout our day, we are consciously channeling that co-creative nature.
Beautiful. Yes. So here we are chatting away, doing what ministers do, talking about prayer. but I really want people to know you. So who are you? Where'd you come from? Have you always been spiritual? When did that first start up in your life? How'd you get from you know, birth to here in 2 minutes? No, I'm just teasing.
2 minutes or less. The 25 words or less. Well, I think all people are all spiritual, but for me, I would say, yes, I have had a little bit of a unique background. I was born in a small town to two teenagers, and I think I came into this life fairly spiritually connected. I mean, I hear stories about my ability to connect with people, what would appear to be kind of like a ability to read people's minds, to be connected to the world beyond form, to see things and sense things. But then I forgot all that, like most kids do. I think most kids are born with this kind of absolute awakening, and then there's this some sort of agreement on this planet to have all of us have spiritual amnesia to regain it. And so I forgot all about that. But I was 6 years old, and I had a little friend who went to church, this thing called church, and our family did not go to church. And I thought that was really fascinating. And so I asked my parents if I could go to church with my friend. And they said, sure. So I went to this cute little Christian church, and I'd had dreams about a man with a beard that I saw who looked very similar to the pictures in the church. And the man with the beard never told me his name or anything like that. I just had dreams about this man over and over again. And I don't know if they were premonition dreams or dreams of actual contact with Jesus or Yeshua, but certainly at that church, I felt this, oh, and I felt at home, and I loved community, and I loved Sunday school, and I loved everything about it. And I would sit in my backyard and go, here's the church, here's the steeple, open the doors and see all the people. I said that almost every day of my little young life. I don't know. It was just some knowingness within me. And when we moved to the big city of Denver, my father insisted that we become Catholic. And so we started going to the Catholic church, and I was confirmed, and I did my first confession and went through all that. And I love the pomp and circumstance. I've always felt this kinship to Jesus, but there were some rules that my family was breaking in the Catholic church. And I feel like we were somewhat unceremoniously ejected and not made as welcome. And so my mother and I, when I was 13, began looking for spirituality elsewhere. We began reading like crazy, and she was always very open-minded, and we had lots of conversations about what could be really going on in the universe. And there were some really key books that we read, and I remember saying to her, are there churches where people believe this stuff? And she said, no. And if there are, they're the fringe people, she called them. And so a few years later, when she was working as a realtor here in Denver, somebody recommended, based on how she talked, that we go to Mile High Church. And so I was 15 years old, and she and I went to a service, and I sat in the room and listened to the music and then the message, and I knew I was home. I just knew it. Like a lot of people report when they go into any spiritual community of any denomination, when it's their first time, that awakening to, hey, this is what matches my sense of myself and what I believe to be true. And I just never left. Been there ever since.
Wow. That's, mm-hmm. You know, I can hear the, you know, here's the church, here's the steeple, open the doors, and there's all the people, you know, you affirming that of and then voila, so many years mm-hmm. later, here you are at that church.
Yeah.
And then, you know, later on, you actually get hired and become the lead, one of the lead ministers. That's just a real story of manifestation then, Michelle.
It is. And I did not ever have a conscious intention to be a minister. I was just interested in healing and growing. There was a bit of trauma in my childhood that I wanted to let go of. And I just felt so at home. And so it was really a rather shocking surprise to me for that inner voice that has guided me. I really do appreciate one of the things in our teaching is that I think we really do want people to listen to their own hearts. I mean, I tell people all the time, even if your heart is telling you to go to another church, I want you to listen to it because you need to follow it and you need to listen to that inner guidance. And so I was really shocked when that inner guidance said to me one day, you should be a minister. And I thought that was the dumbest idea that I'd ever heard. Why would I do that? Ministers are boring. And they, I mean, I loved our ministers, but what? I was going to be an actor. I was going to either, I thought I would either be a broadcast news journalist or possibly a stage or screen actor of some sort. And I was pursuing a degree in theater, communications and theater at university, and had no thought of being a minister. And so it kind of turned my life upside down, that one little explosion of intuitive awareness.
How long did it take from that moment? Like, you did you have to convince yourself? Were there signs along the way that kind of kept you in line on that path? Like, how did, from that first initial?
There were some incredible signs. It took 5 years, quite frankly. And ministers are born. it took 5 years. And what the path looked like is I thought we have these wonderful spiritual leaders called practitioners in our denomination that are like spiritual directors and prayer ministry. And I saw them doing this great work and I kept feeling this push and kept feeling this push. And I thought to myself, I could do that. I could do that. And when I went to discover what it would take to be a minister, it was this big, long, drawn out story of having to move away and spend all this money. I was already spending money on university and it was kind of overwhelming. So I kind of set it aside, but I thought I could do the practitioner path. I would love that. So I kept going and doing all my classwork. Meanwhile, I got a job at Mile High Church. I saw how hard the ministers worked and that firmly established that I would never want to be a minister. And so I said, okay, I've got to figure it out, practitioner for me. But as you know, in the practitioner training, a lot of that work is to, I call it, burn away the not self so that one can reveal to themselves who they really are and what their true nature is. And it was in the second year of that training that I literally had a moment in my process where I fell to my knees and I said, okay, I get it. I'm supposed to do ministry. I will surrender. I will stop resisting. I will stop fighting. And I went into Mile High Church the next day and told our senior minister, Dr. Roger, I have decided that I'm going to become a minister. And I was about to say, and I know that means I have to move to Los Angeles to go to school. And he said, oh, well, that's so interesting. We've just decided to open a school of ministry right here at Mile High Church.
Wow. What year was that?
That was probably 1986-ish.
Oh my gosh, Michelle. How old were you?
23, 24. And so I was the first student to enroll. I wasn't the first student to graduate because we had Dr. Patty had already been going to school in LA and she was able to transfer and then graduate. But I was in the second year that our school had graduates, and that was in 1991. And wow. It took 4 years. It took a little longer. I actually withdrew from university and turned all of my attention to my ministerial studies and loved every minute of it. Loved it. Just loved it and never regretted it. Never regretted it.
So you've been working. So what were you doing when you first worked at Mile High?
Well, I started off as the receptionist. You know, Mile High Church, this is Michelle. Can I help you? And just answering phones and helping people around. And then there were some shifts in the staff. I was let go for just a few months because they were having some financial issues and needed to reorganize. And then I was brought back in. And at that point, I was the events director. So I brought in all of the, worked with mostly Dr. Roger Teal to bring in all of the big name speakers, Wayne Dyers and all those people, Marianne Williamson's, all those people, Deepak Chopra, all those people to the church. I was the office manager and I was the administrative assistant to five ministers. Now, keep in mind, this was before we even had technology. There wasn't email. I kept all of their schedules on paper and kept track of it and kept them up to date and scheduled appointments and all of that. So I had a pretty big job and it was really very powerful on the job training because I watched them do things that were amazing. And I watched them do things that were really questionable and didn't work out. And so it was beyond the education that I was getting in the school. It was really good training. Good.
Wow. That's just stunning to be that age and to be on, to have such curiosity about the human condition and, you know, why things get to be the way they are. And also to be like meeting these big stars or be authors of books that you're probably studying must have been phenomenal for you.
It has been. Yeah. It's been phenomenal in that way. It's really helped me stay on that personal growth path and learn that it's never done. I think that people think that, oh, I'm going to get to this point where I've learned everything I need to learn and then I'll be enlightened and then I'll just live my life. And in my personal estimation, there's always depth to be plumbed. There's always a deeper experience of the divine. There's always a deeper experience with our healing journey. There's always more to be revealed about who we are and how we can shine in our life on this planet. And so I think what I learned in those early years was to enjoy that process. And even though it's not always fun or pleasant, it always reveals magnificence. And that's what I'm about for myself and others.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Well, I can only imagine the depth of learning from being in that role of, you know, helping all those different ministers and meeting all those incredible people, being like front row, if you will, listening to all of this amazing information that they share. And now you are that lead minister. Mm-hmm. How many ministers are there at the My Lai Church?
Let's see, I think there's six of us who are full-time and then about five who are very, very part-time who serve one particular area. So 11 total. But we have a staff ministry that's called a special focus minister where they just are on our team as a minister, but they may say, for example, run our healing ministry or small groups or different elements, women's ministry, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So now you're in the position you're in, and you think back to those days when you were assisting 12 ministers. Like, how do you feel now? You know, was it as easy that, you know, based on what you were taking in as the assistant, and you said some people, you were surprised at some of the decisions or the things they did, and you know, you kind of got a peek behind the scene. So now you're actually that person. Mm-hmm. You know, is it all it was cracked up to be in your mind when you were so young? Do you extend those ministers a bit more grace for what you saw them going through when you were in the assistant position?
I do. And I do think that the world has changed pretty drastically, especially in the last few years, and ministry has changed and is changing. And so I don't have a full-time personal assistant like I was for those people. And I kind of mostly schedule my own appointments. I do have one person who helps me out with that occasionally. And I have staff members who can help with certain projects, but they're kind of spread through the organization. It's not just one source. So that's a little bit different. But as far as I understand what can often keep people from ministers, from saying everything they need to say. And I think I learned that both in both roles. Like there are times when I'm working with an employee who's going through something and it's private and confidential and they're not ready to share it, but it's impacting their work or their ability to be as productive as they might usually be. And one doesn't just go out to the whole staff and say, well, XYZ employee is having a problem with their spouse who's drinking too much. And so we all need to send them a little bit of grace, right? There might come a place where you might be able to do that. But I really do understand that ministers are people and ministers are working often very intimately with volunteers and staff members and board members. And as much as we want to say in our communities, we should be transparent, we also have to understand that ministers aren't withholding information a lot of times just to be rude or to be secretive. And I think that there's sometimes for people who are looking at those leaders, they think that there's ill intention, ill intent at afoot at times, because there have been spiritual leaders in our world and even our own movement who have had ill intent or who've made big mistakes. So I've learned to, I guess you could say, extend the benefit of the doubt. I've learned to go directly to a colleague or an employee if I see something going wrong. I've learned that that's the best route, rather than sitting back and feeling resentful and making up a story and wondering what's going on, and trusting that if I'm not to hear the whole story of something, that there's probably a good reason for that.
Perfect. All right, good time for a break. We're going to jump off for just a minute and we'll be back right after the break.
Free my mind, open my heart with the whispers of truth, to live a conscious life, to live a conscious life on the growing edge. On the growing edge.
And now, here's Allie.
We're back. So we've been talking about you and your evolution, and you and I, we recently met about a year ago, and a year ago, I think in June, and we met because of the Enneagram.
Yes.
And we are both taking a course with none other than your beloved mother as our teacher. And so Linda Frazee, and for some of my guests, you would have caught her a couple of weeks ago. We did a rebroadcast of her show that I did with her several months ago. She's an amazing woman, was a therapist for many years, and now is putting a lot of energy and attention into leaving a legacy of her, what she knows about the Enneagram. And so we're taking this course. And so Michelle and I are becoming to know each other quite well through the lens of the Enneagram, especially. And so having said that, how has your ministry evolved over the years? You know, knowing that you're now studying the Enneagram, and I think I heard you mention that you're putting together an Enneagram website. And so that would tell me that your ministry is evolving. So how has that been over the last few years as you've been now the lead minister, or one of the lead ministers at Mile High?
Well, since my mother began teaching the Enneagram in the late 90s, I have been taking classes from her. And then I benefited very much in my community at New Vision Center in Arizona by having her come and do Enneagram typings and workshops, most especially in church life with our leadership, say our board and our staff. It helped us tremendously to understand the Enneagram and to understand the different numbers on the Enneagram, who was represented and who wasn't. For example, on a board of trustees or a leadership council, by whatever name they go by, to not have, say, the number six type person who's paying attention to risk, who's looking forward and looking ahead, who might question a lot, might question motives. It's very easy in our happy, positive, new thought communities to hope and try to leave that kind of person aside because they can be rather irritable. And yet, what I really learned from my mother in those days was the balance of all of those voices. Number one represents the community better because all of those voices are represented in the people who are at your community. Number two makes you a more powerful organization with greater integrity because you're getting to hear the different viewpoints and learning to work with each other. And so I found that the lens of the Enneagram helped us from a leadership position. So one of my intentions in now being certified is to possibly support other communities like ours in using this tool to create that kind of integrity for themselves, for their boards and their staffs. And I also feel that we're being blessed to go deeper with it. And I see from a spiritual standpoint, the study of the essence of each number of the Enneagram, which gives me new awareness about the spiritual nature, which I believe we all have that essence, but the essence of each number really is speaking to me pretty profoundly right now in terms of the general person in that might be interested in learning about it. So I don't know exactly what I plan to do with it, but I can see some wisdom and I'm having a lot of fun and getting to know you, and I'm growing myself, which is of course a huge part of my intention.
Yeah. As you were saying that, you know, I've served on a few boards myself, and it can be a bit tricky when you've got someone that's, you know, more skeptical or doubting, pointing out the things that aren't working. But it's really helpful because, like you said, if you had a whole board of directors or leadership team that were all twos and threes, you know, the high achievers and the happy ones, and, you know, we probably wouldn't get the depth and the richness that having maybe each of the, at least the centers, the head center, the heart center, and the body center represented.
Right. Yeah. And then there's blind spots, right? And that's the kind of leadership structure that means that some little detail that's going to bite you in the butt organizationally, financially, or from a bylaws perspective, a legal issue, might not be seen because everybody's just being happy, happy, joy, joy. And while I think our teaching is a great teaching to create more happiness and more joy for people, it can't come at the setting aside, looking at what appears to be so and meeting what appears to be so. And I also think that if you have someone who comes onto your board or your leadership team, who's more of an observer or more of the head type, they can get a lot of gruff from the other members who are like, oh, they're so negative. They're always looking at the negative side of things. And when we understand what their motivation really is and can see that sweetness that can happen with those types, we can make it more welcome and have a little lightheartedness about it, and actually then begin to use the beauty and the brilliance of those types to help us be a more well-rounded community. So mm-hmm. I find that really fascinating.
So have you done this with the board that you currently are working with, or the leadership people?
No. No, my mother did a very comprehensive training. I think it was two summers ago with our staff. We paid her and invited our entire staff, which we have a rather large staff at Mile High Church. Mostly I think it was the full-time employees to come and do a training with her. And it has helped us all in terms of how we work together to understand a little bit more about our coworkers. Types. It's helped us ministers to understand each other's types. As Josh and I are lead ministers together in a partnership, it's definitely, I can't speak for him, but I'm an only guess that it's helped us in our working relationship to understand. And one of the things that I think it helps tremendously is that the way that people are, like isn't it the first rule of the four agreements is don't take things personally. And when I'm working with a partner who's a two, who goes out of his way to help me or help other people and to connect, and if I feel slighted in any way with that, I can now not take that so personally because mm-hmm. I understand, oh, Josh is doing what he is most motivated to do, to connect mm-hmm. and help people. I get that about him. It doesn't mean that I can't say something about it, or I can't challenge him on it, or I can't have a conversation with him about it. But the place that I will come from now in that understanding of what it means to live and lead as a two in the world is a completely different awareness on my part. And I think the same would probably go for him with me, who leads as a three, who's like, hello world, here I am, you know, standing out, making lots of noise. I know I haven't done that on this podcast yet, so I'm working on it. But I think it helps him and the other my other colleagues, for us to really see each other through that lens a little bit more powerfully and compassionately. So it's helped tremendously.
Yeah, I really think that the Enneagram helps us with communicating, you know, it knowing each other's types, whether it's within your work or within your family, gives you a greater sense of, gives you a bit more compassion.
Yeah.
And for how others move and groove in the world, if they're more introverted or more extroverted, knowing their type seems to settle things down and gives a particular language that is true and kind.
Yeah.
You know, the kindness and a truth to being able to talk to someone's type. My husband's a two as well. And so knowing that he's strongly motivated to help, he's just going to go out of his way to make sure everyone's needs are met. And it's been undeniable even before the Enneagram. I knew this about him and really supported him in that. But now it's, you know, that there's a bit more humor that can come too as we joke about these things.
Right.
You know, I'm a four, so I like to go deep and I'm very emotional and can be a little bit moody sometimes. So we could, you know, it's just brought some light to that. It's not so serious when he's being super two-ish and I'm being super four-ish. We can say, hey, hold on, what's going on here? And you made a you said a phrase or a term, you used a term, the not self. And you know, I'm thinking back to human design when I hear that not self.
Yes.
But I also can see it with the Enneagram when we're so wrapped up in our personality as whatever type we lead with, we can, you know, move to that sort of heavier place with that. And that's what I think is the not self. It's like, oh, here I go again, spiraling into my emotions, feeling a little bit overly melancholy for no reason. You know, it's like, oop, there I am. And
yeah,
like we were talking about earlier with the prayer, you know, bringing myself up to a place of remembering who I really am as a powerful co-creator. I think the Enneagram is just a beautiful way to sort of expose some of these blind spots or expose the motivation behind why we do what we do, and even gives us a bit more space to maybe explore some other ways. You know, what else motivates me besides, you know, feeling like I have to go super deep or I have to make stand out and be unique and special, or, you know, I can catch myself and call upon some of the other qualities that that are assigned to some of the other types. And just for clarity, it's even though we may lead with a particular type or number, we have the ability to expand into all of the great qualities of all of the different types.
Yes, we do. And we have a connection specifically to a number of other numbers. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm realizing that one thing that I've been thinking a lot about, and I wonder if you have too, being in a community, what I also know about human nature is we tend to project. So we tend to project our lens. We look through, so you as a four, you look through four colored glasses at the world and other people, and I do as a three. And so in spiritual community, when we come together in a group or even in a company or a family, or anytime we come together as a group, one of the greatest challenges to resolving conflict and being in loving communication is the game of projection. And the Enneagram is just one way we project. So I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of being a minister in a church with a group of people who are spanning all of these numbers on the Enneagram. And it can go anywhere from the funny things, like the people who lead in the one energy are the people who are going, it's top of the hour and the surface is going over 2 minutes. It's gone over. Is anybody noticing? It's gone over. Whereas the four, if they're getting some authentic, beautiful sharing from the minister, I don't want them to ever stop. I want them to keep talking. I hope that we go over because I need to hear everything they're saying. I mean, those are two very diverse perceptions that are going on in our communities. And then we get feedback as leaders. Well, you should do it. The one is saying, you should do it my way. And the four say, oh, you should do it my way.
Right.
How do I, as a spiritual leader, know this, remember this? How do I, as a member of a family, remember this, in a company, remember this, and know that whether or not you subscribe to the Enneagram or believe in it, this is the truth of human nature. We are projecting onto each other all the time, and our very strong perceptions about what should be happening are often born out of our woundology, or born out of our type, or born out of all our experience, all sorts of things. And learning to know ourselves well enough to do exactly what you said. Oh, there I go again. I'm projecting my perfectionistic tendencies onto them. I'm going to take a deep breath and just get present. That's part of the work, I think, of the Enneagram, and try to call upon the essence of myself as a one or a four or a three or whatever. And so this just gives, like the prayer you talked about in the beginning, gives some structure to how we can do what all of us need to do to some extent or another.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I was thinking when you said projection, it's interesting because when you're not aware of the Enneagram, let's say all the, you know, the different types, we may have a thought, well, you know, being a four, for example, I'm like hyper-focused on whether people are authentic,
right,
if they're going to, like, and before I knew the Enneagram, it was, I'm embarrassed to say this, like, it was a little disappointing. Like, I wanted people to be more like me. Like, I wanted to have relationships that went deep, that were you know, authentic. And so knowing the Enneagram and knowing these nine different sort of archetypes or personality structures that people seem to fall into one of them, it now gives me a sense of like, oh, I don't wish everyone to be just like me. Mm-hmm. I appreciate my daughter that's a six, my husband that's a two, my friend that's a nine. And it's, I'm not projecting, oh, they should be more mean, you know, deep, or they should be that, like, they are who they are. And it gives me this like deep appreciation and respect. It really helps so much. And then when you were talking about working with a leadership team, there's one team that I worked with for several years, and before I knew the Enneagram, that is, and I was, my role as a four, now I see it, was more of the visionary. Like, I would have these big ideas. I could like talk about how the big picture and how this would feel and affect everyone. And then there were others that were like, didn't even acknowledge that. So, you know, my feelings were hurt. Didn't acknowledge the benefit of that. But that individual will be super structured, super on task, knew how to get systematize things. And well, that is so, you know, I do have a line to one, I must say,
but
it's not something that I would choose to, you know, raise my hand for. And so, you know, I can look back now and have a bit more appreciation for the groups I have worked with in the past that did have those different types, so to speak, different Enneagram types that really made for a beautiful cohesive team, because we did come from, thank God, we weren't all ones or fours, right?
Yeah. And you can allow for the diversity a little bit more powerfully. And in any environment, when we can be centered in who we are, and not be expecting, as you say, for people to be like us, but be who we are fully and appreciate and allow other beings to be who they are fully, I think we're happier, we're more productive, we're able to accomplish more together. And that's part of what has drawn me back into spiritual community over and over and over again, because I'm I'm quite frankly amazed at what we can do together versus if I try to do something all by myself. It might be good. I might have some great success here and there because I've got some good skills. But when there's this collaborative energy of how we solved the problem or how we created something that really moved and inspired people or how we really helped people grow and expand their awareness, that is very soul satisfying to me. And it happens through that connection of oneness and diversity, that we're all connected, we all have the same intention, and we bring our diverse energy to it, and we can appreciate each other's diverse energy. So I think this work with the Enneagram is just one of those structures that helps us have that appreciation. Wow, I'm going to just say to you right now, it looks like outside here in Denver, it is sunny and snowing. Very strange. Okay, I'll check that out later.
So, well, I'm looking outside and there's some snow clouds out there too. We have snow on the mountains. So you have this unique opportunity being the leader of such a big community. And I'm not talking just about the staff and all the people that you see on a regular basis, the volunteers, but the entire group of people that show up at Mile High every Sunday or classes throughout the week. You have this unique opportunity to really gauge, you know, how are people doing out there? You've got a big slice of society coming in. I don't have that at the moment. And so I'm interested to know, like, how are people doing? You've got your finger on the pulse of a big, big, you know, amount of people. What are people struggling with? What's going well in the world? Because from my little corner of the world, if I turn on social media or, you know, look at the news or, you know, that doesn't give me a read on the spiritual folk out there, people that are seeking. What's not going so well? What's going well these days?
I feel like that the news has it right a little bit that people are struggling with loneliness and isolation, and some people are continuing to keep themselves isolated, but fewer and fewer and fewer people are doing that. We had a huge attendance yesterday for our Easter services, and I think that's an indication that more and more people are coming out into groups. Now, while they're out with us, what I'm hearing about in classes and in speaking with people is that this is a very charged year with the it being an election year, and already the diverse conversations happening, the challenge with how to stay in a loving space when we watch people in the news who are either diametrically opposed to the values we hold dear or who say things that seem crazy and out of alignment, or who are doing things in leadership that we just don't agree with. It seems like people are struggling with how to stay centered and how to stay loving with all that. And we still have a number of months until the actual election. So I know that people are struggling with that, and they're looking for answers. They're looking for relevant content and relevant strategies for doing that and finding it really difficult. As well as, I think that there's a struggle with the violence going on in the world, not only the violence in, of course, Russia, but in the Middle East, in Gaza, in Israel, finding peace in our hearts with how to hold any of that. So they're very rich conversations. And out of that, I feel like people are seeking comfort. They're seeking prayer. They're seeking a spiritual community that will provide them techniques and mindsets to be able to stay centered. And also, I personally feel like it's so challenging because a lot of times people in the communities don't want the church or spiritual leaders to take a side. They don't want us to support one or the other, but then people who are really activated want us to take a side one way or another in any of the conversations. And it's hard as a spiritual leader. I have my personal beliefs about all of it, but I don't have any agenda to influence people like that. And I think that's really hard in this day and age as a spiritual leader, when people want you to take a stand for women's rights or take a stand for one political party over another, or take a, and it can be very challenging. So
yeah, I can only imagine. So I have one question for you. I ask this to all of my guests, and you know the song, "What the World Needs Now Is Love, Sweet Love."
Yes,
and that is true.
It is.
What does the world need right now, Michelle? As you've shared everything that you have, what would you leave everyone with? What do we need?
I think the world needs what it's always needed from each one of us, and that is a willingness to go within and access our own inner nature, to continue to be seekers of the divine within us that can guide us in our life, that the world has always needed us not to make decisions about ourselves or others from the outside in, but to be a place of listening. In most of our New Thought Centers every week, we sing some song at the end that talks about let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. And that has not changed, and nor will it ever change. No matter what's going on in the world, what the world needs is for us to become the best, most centered, spiritually activated version of ourselves, and then listen to the guidance about what is ours to do, whether it's to go out and to protest or go out and lead or go forth and stay very quiet and prayerful on our meditation pillow. There's room for everyone as long as we all stay centered in ourselves. That's what I would
say. Beautiful. That's a wonderful way to wrap things up. And thank you, Michelle, so much for being my guest today. It's been
such a joy.
I love you, and I'll see you in Denver in a couple of months.
Look forward to it.
Yeah, and thank you everyone for watching today. Next week, we're going to have Arjuna, our dog, on the show. And thank you to New Thought Media Network, the Satya Center, and our beautiful producer, Michael. Bye-bye, everyone.
Free my mind, open my heart with the whispers of truth, to live a conscious life, to live a conscious life on the growing.